Hello, you're very welcome to the podcast series Driving Progress with Audi. I'm the host, Emma Dabaru, and in the upcoming episodes, I'll be speaking to Audi Ireland brand ambassadors to explore how they live their passions and beliefs and find out what has driven them to be successful and progressive in their chosen fields. We welcome you to experience Progress with Audi. Today, I'll be speaking to Sonia Lennon, one of Ireland's biggest names in fashion, working as a designer, broadcaster, author, and also an Audi Ireland brand ambassador. Hello, Sonia.
Hello, Emma.
How's 2022 treating you so far?
Yeah, it's funny. Look, we're in crazy times, right? We all know that. I think everything has coincided for me to be a stage of life, a stage of being, a stage of change. I think I turned 53 years ago, and for me, that was a real pivot point in terms of, I suppose, who I am and what I need to do. And I think now that's kind of almost culminating into a point where I need to unlearn, slough off everything that I thought, all the stories that I tell myself, and rebuild them for a new phase. So, I think that's really exciting. I've no idea what's going to come out of it. I know I have a lot of resources to work with, and it's almost sort of like reshaping the jigsaw puzzle. So I'm excited.
I just need to pick my jaw up off the floor at you being 50. So that took me by surprise. Sonia, what kind of things would you say define you as a person?
I think what's really important to me, because somebody gave me a gorgeous diary, and in the front of the diary, this is last year, it said, list out the 10 or 12 highlights from last year. And I initially went through my digital diary, which is predominantly work engagements and work appointments. And then I went back and read the small print, which said it might be helpful to go through your camera roll. So the work diary didn't particularly surface any high point. But when I went through the camera roll and I really started to list out the high points, there were such simple things like swims and walks and food and laughing and drinks and friends. And they weren't the kind of height scaling moments of professional achievement necessarily. They were just when you feel at your happiest. And I think it was so liberating to know that that's the good stuff, you know. And yeah. I think COVID has really helped us with that, to unpick what really makes us happy at the end of the day.
Yeah.
So in other words, what defines me is people, relationships, communication, and changing and learning. I think I'm very, very mindful that we cannot be a sort of a fixed state. We have to keep changing. And in fact, we keep changing whether we like it or not. You know, we're not the same person yesterday that we are today or tomorrow or whatever. So knowing that and accepting that is a start, I suppose. Now that said, before we finish up on that point, I definitely found a massive void where culture lived. And, you know, recent, very lucky to have been at a beautiful gig with Camille O'Sullivan in the Pepper Canister Church a couple of months ago, went to the theatre, and those sort of soul-feeding moments where you're seeing culture and experiencing culture, they've taken on a kind of a religious momentum now.
Yeah.
That you go, oh, wow, this is amazing to be interacting with art in that way. You're like a kid at Christmas now.
If you think about progress, Sonia, what does progress mean to you?
To me, it's about an iterative process because progress is not linear. It doesn't move in a positive direction at all times. Part of that is making mistakes, failing, reflecting, learning, moving on again. So it's almost like a sort of a heartbeat. Like for me, last year, I went back and I did a master's in business equity, diversity and inclusion.
Oh, wow.
So I had never done a degree. I'd never done formal third level education before. So that was like, I surprised myself by how much I liked the rigor of it, the process of it, because I'm not great at following the rules per se. it was a kind of a personal validation. Not that I ever felt, I never ever had an issue with not having achieved a degree, ever. because that was my choice. I wanted to get into the workplace. I wanted to learn by doing, not by, you know, by reading or hypothesizing. So yeah. I never had a problem with that. But the fact that the master's is completed now in a topic that I'm really passionate about, it just feels really, really good. And worst case scenario, I can say, oh, COVID, yeah, I did a master's. So that's progress. And it's kind Absolutely. Of time well spent, you know?
In terms of your personal passions, in what way have they informed your career, or have you used them within your career?
Oh, I mean, definitely. And if I go back to the sort of primary passion, only about 3 or 4 years ago, I had this epiphany around why I love clothes. And it's because my mum was a transatlantic air hostess, and she used to go to New York and Boston and Chicago.
Well, the glamour.
Oh, unbelievable. Like, it was, you know, she was the mom. So we were eating, you know, all sorts of ethnic cuisine when everybody else was only having chops and peas. And I had leg warmers when nobody else had leg warmers. And, you know, this was, you know, I was the cool kid.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah. And actually, I only realized that it was that fire and the passion and the joy that I got from being able to share that new experience. So I'd rock up wearing whatever I'd wear, and people would go, oh my God, that's amazing. Where'd you get that? And so it wasn't just the feeling great about looking different or interesting. It was actually the kind of ripple effect of that on the people around me. So I could kind of see that joyfulness about how you present yourself has a very positive impact. And I think it all started with there. And that's why I went into styling to paint pictures with clothes. It's why I founded Dress for Success, which is now Work Equal, to help women to present themselves better, to feel more empowered to succeed. Mm-hmm. And everything kind of came from that our outer casing, as sort of superficial as it might seem, is really, really important from a sort of an anthropological point of view. We need, if we have that power, we can either fake it till we make it or feel like we have enough to propel us. And so from that, I suppose the passion became, well, you know, how can we empower people to step into their potential, to be the best version of themselves for them and those around them? And that's why I suppose for me that the master's was, I'd been on this sort of gender empowerment, female empowerment journey, which is brilliant, and I'm massively passionate about it. Mm-hmm. But I actually think it to be relevant now, it needs to spread out to everybody. It's not a woman's issue. It's a societal issue. It's an economic issue. Mm-hmm. It's a business issue. Mm-hmm. And so for me, it's as important that everybody feels like they belong, they're empowered, they have a voice, they can be heard. Because unless everybody feels like that, then I have this analogy around, you know, if you're going to try and empower an underrepresented or a marginalized group within a whole incumbent power group, it's like trying to introduce exotic fish into dirty water, because the way we're working isn't working right now. So we need to look at the nuts and bolts of how everybody feels. So, you know, does the lowest ranking member of your workforce, even if they're a white male, feel empowered, feel heard, feel like they belong? Yeah. And if they don't, then there's an issue.
I'm reading a book at the moment called Wintering by Catherine May. I think you'd absolutely love it.
I know it. Yes.
Yeah, it's fantastic. And I'm just getting to the end of it now. And the last passage that I read was very similar to what your good doctor was saying. It was talking about the pronounced positive impact of kindness and caring from one person to another, and the way that is like this, it just has all of these incredibly wonderful side effects related to practicing kindness. So, you know, that's wonderful. And I feel like as well,
it's also very difficult to replicate kindness in AI. So, you know, that kindness and caring is the human domain. So we really need to step into that, I think.
In what ways, in what ways have you adapted your outlook on things as you've gotten older? When you talk about unlearning and stuff, are there certain things that, you know, have quite explicitly changed or that you view different, very differently?
I think there is, for me, a sort of a fundamental strand, which is value-led around what is acceptable, what I attract, what I put out in terms of like good old-fashioned respect and kindness and even a sense of personal positioning, that you don't take yourself too seriously, because that's very easily done. And, you know, we're all only flesh and blood at the end of the day. And we're all probably much more similar than we give ourselves credit for, regardless of our circumstance or our territory or who we are or what we are. But in terms of things that have changed, I think I've changed at this stage of my life in terms of, I put it to you this way. When I turned 50, I kind of felt that's 50 years of learning. What are we going to do about it? And how are we going to apply it in the next 50 years? So it's like you cross a bridge and you say, okay, there is a value to the life I've lived and what I've learned and the experiences I've had, and almost a sort of a duty to use them wisely now, because it matters to me what I do with the rest of my life. In terms of even my physical self, I've become really, really aware of my personal strength, fitness, all that kind of stuff. That's really become a priority for me, not through any vanity or anything like that. It's just I don't want to have to make funny sounds when I bend down. I don't want to have to creak and ache. For as long as I can avoid that, I will do what I can to make my body fit and well. Now, life has a funny way of socking you in the jaw when you least expect it. And if that comes, it comes. But at least I'll have given it everything that I can. So yeah, it's definitely a time of life thing. And I think for me and for a lot of my friends, that kind of crossing the bridge moment is a fantastic liberation. Like it gives you freedom to make much braver decisions. And we can't decide necessarily what happens to us, but we can decide how we respond to it. And that's, for me, that's the nugget, you know. We are the product of our responses.
Can you tell us a little bit more about the work that you do around gender equality and your organization?
Yeah, so, well, Work Equal, as it is now rebranded, exists to help women to succeed at interviews. So those women could be any woman, you know, you or me on a bad day. It's not about any particular social class or demographic or anything like that. If you need help to improve your confidence to succeed at interview and therefore achieve economic independence, Work Equal is there for you. And so we've served over 3,000 women back into employment. And so at a sort of a above the tide mark, we give them clothing to present that's theirs for free. We mentor them with a HR professional. But then beyond that, it's about sort of continuing development, mentoring, financial literacy, anything that can help that woman's incline to stay moving in the right direction. And I just, my mom had two phrases that she used to use all the time when I was growing up, and they really stuck with me, which was always have your running away money, because money is choice. And if you're not part of the revenue, you're not part of the decision making. And so my mum worked all through my childhood. And so that huge value placed on independence through financial independence was not lost on me. And I think it's probably shaped everything that I've done through my career and my life. But I suppose what we found with Work Equal was, yes, we're giving these women the support they need at grassroots to get into employment. But about sort of 6 years ago, the penny dropped that, you know, the environment that they were entering into was full of these landmines that were stopping them from achieving their full potential. So we started to move towards advocating at a policy level around changing the landscape of work for women. And so, you know, I've been to the European Parliament in Brussels.
Oh, wow.
I'm part of the cross-party Oireachtas group on gender equality in the workplace, presented to the Oireachtas. And so we run an annual conference, Work Equal Conference, which looks to, I suppose, surface the solutions, because I'm really not interested in the problems. We all know what the problems are. Yeah. The bigger question is, what are the solutions and how can we get there? So last year, the last couple of years, actually, we had been focused on gender pay gap. And now that that's been drafted into legislation, although the methodology hasn't been launched yet, that feels like a sort of a semi tick. I'm very mindful that gender pay gap legislation is... Gender pay gap is a symptom, not the cause. So we need to get to the cause. And the next bit, really, the next piece for us is around sustainable childcare. And really, until we have a sustainable childcare system, we're always going to be fighting, because women are, you know, by far and away the predominant carers and take up the majority of caring duties. So it's really about kind of looking at what are the strands that can make a real difference, and who can be pulled together to create momentum around that. So, I mean, that creates a fire in my belly, even though I'm, you know, if I'm campaigning for childcare reform, I'm doing it potentially for my daughter if she decides to have kids, or my son if he decides to have kids when the time is right. I'm not doing it for me at this stage, that's for sure. But I think the value of creating a more equitable environment for parents, and again, this isn't about women, it's about mothers and fathers, and mothers and mothers and fathers and fathers, where men can be part of that early years development piece. Research has proven that that is beneficial for both the child and the parent.
Oh, 100%. And this like childcare is a topic that's very close to my heart as a working mother with two young children. So what does sustainable childcare look like? Like, so what's the model that we would be working towards?
So we work quite closely with the Icelandic administration with Work Equal, and they have implemented free universal. Well, it's not quite free. It's very, very supplemented by not by the government, funny enough, but by the municipalities. So it would be run by the equivalent of our county councils. And obviously that has to be funded through government. But when I spoke to the Icelandic ambassador to the UK, and I said, if I was to go to the Irish government and ask them why we should implement free, sustainable or supplemented sustainable quality childcare, what's the biggest argument? And he said, really simply, it's the bottom line, that wherever it has been implemented, at the bare minimum, it has been cost zero. And where it's worked really well, it has increased the GDP by 20%. So this is about the double X economy, getting women back into the workplace to create a better society and economy for everybody. So, look, it's numbers at the end of the day.
And is there thirst for it? Do you think it will happen? Is it something in the kind of the near future, potentially?
It's being radical. Talked about. Yeah, it's being talked about. And I think the way to do it, I have my laser sights on a couple of county councils. I think if we could trial it, sponsored by local enterprises, there is potentially a way to do it. And I think what happened in Reykjavik, where they launched the programme initially, was that other municipalities realised that they had to roll it out to create any kind of competitive status. So if one county council decides that they're going to be the county council or the county that has free, sustainable, universal childcare, then other councils will have to sit up and go, well, what are we going to do to make sure that we keep our businesses alive and thriving and our economies alive and thriving? So I think what it looks like in real terms, ultimately, I'm not sure, but certainly driving towards a vision and having a vision. And that's what's missing in policy at the moment is, in terms of that childcare piece, what does really great look like? Nobody has defined that. Yeah. And until you define it, you can't get there.
Amazing. Well, yeah, I will be keeping abreast of this movement, because the whole childcare situation is a lot. Sonia, can you tell us something that people wouldn't necessarily expect when they hear your name? Sorry, it's really putting you on the spot.
They probably don't expect that cheese puffs are my favorite snack. They probably don't expect me to have driven Nürburgring with Audi the only woman in a cohort of people who went there.
Wow.
Many of the men did vomit from G-force. I will just say that I did not.
yeah,
so that was a major thrill. What else do they not know about me? Perhaps that I rang the bell to close the NASDAQ.
Wow.
Perhaps that I had tea in Downing Street with Samantha Cameron. Perhaps that I'm a really terrible packer. what else? What else? That's probably enough.
I think that was a lot. That was hit after hit. Thank you so much. I have found our conversation deeply inspiring and entertaining.
Aww.
So thank you for sharing all of your wisdom and for being a part of Driving Progress with Audi.
It's been my pleasure.